the show.
Well, hey, everyone. Welcome to this week's show. I'm Lisa Anderson. Very excited to be with you. I want to let you know, because we're coming down to the wire, that you only have a couple more days to register for Pursuit 2015 at our current rate of $225 before it goes up. So those of you who are listening, you need to hop over to boundless.org/pursuit and get registered. July 9th through 11th here in beautiful Colorado Springs. We know we had a fabulous time last year. This year will be no exception. So register. May 31st is the last day that you can register at the current rate before rates go up. So boundless.org/pursuit. Well, later on in the show, we're going to have a question answering the question, am I unapproachable? I mean, who hasn't like asked that at some point? Just wondering, or maybe that's just me. I don't know, but we're going to get some good insight on that. And then for our culture segment, we have Oz Guinness to talk about his book, God in the Dark. Many of you know Oz Guinness. He's been around like forever just as a theologian, as a speaker, as an author, as a cultural analyst. And here he's going to tackle the issue of doubt. What does that mean to doubt? Is it okay to doubt? But here we are for our roundtable. I'm excited to have actually a couple in the studio with me. Usually it's a random, you know, just hodgepodge of, you know, a ragtag following of people. We have fun with them too. But actually I have Micah and Tiffany Sage here with me. Hey guys.
Hello.
Hi.
Great to have you guys in the studio, because we're going to tell, they are going to be part of telling a story today, their story, which I think has great, will have great impact on a lot of people, and just really a story of God's goodness in the midst of a journey that has involved, you know, everyone thinks, you know, that everyone else's lives are just picture perfect and they've made all the right decisions and they've trusted God their whole lives and stuff. And then we find out, you know, we think we're the only ones that haven't. But then we see that God truly grows us in our faith through a number of different experiences. So thanks, you guys, for being here. So I want to start kind of at the beginning of the story, which kind of begins with you, Micah, dating, not being a believer. When did you become a believer? When did you accept Christ?
That was 2003.
Okay, yeah. And you were how old?
I was 21.
Okay, yeah. So 21.
So now we all know how old I am.
Okay. That's okay. So you were 21, but you were actually dating prior to this. Tell us about your experience. You were dating what, like a pastor's daughter?
I was, yeah. I was, I met a girl through some friends. Mm-hmm. From home. I'm from St. Louis, Missouri. Mm-hmm. And I was going to school in Ohio, and I was home for the summer, and some friends introduced me to a girl I just started dating, and she was a pastor's daughter, and a believer, a mm-hmm. Christian, and we just struck up a relationship over the summer, and then we just kept it going long distance, because she was going to school in St. Louis. So
okay, now did she know that you weren't a Christian, or were you kind of trying to play it off like you were, or assuming you were?
I wasn't pretending.
Okay.
I grew up in a family where I was in a traditional church, so I was going to services weekly, but I just my faith wasn't mine, mm-hmm. and I think she knew that mm-hmm. already, because mm-hmm. She had asked me out to her church a few times, and it wasn't the church that her dad was pastoring at the time, but. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So tell us a little bit, like move us along in the story of the direction that your relationship took and kind of what happened, and really a pivotal moment for you.
Yeah, sure. So we dated sophomore year and junior year. And during the course of that time, it became a physical relationship, mm-hmm. To be honest. So, but I had no restraints on my own. Mm-hmm. I mean, my faith wasn't anything. Mm-hmm. And so nothing was really constraining me. Mm-hmm. And so I definitely led her astray for sure. Mm. And then it was after midterms of my junior year, I got an email from her. I had actually spent probably that night partying, because midterms had just finished. But mm. then next morning I woke up, and I got an email from her and said, I've been trying to tell you this all week. I know that you've been stressed, so I haven't really been, I have a hard time kind of bringing this up, but, you know, I got pregnant and I had an abortion.
And this was all within the span of, I mean, this was really a decision that she made on her own. And it had been really, like, so she just found out she was pregnant, made the decision right away, and had the abortion right away.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because I was going back at least once a month or so to St. Louis to visit, or she would come up to visit Ohio. And so I think I would have known if she was far along.
Okay.
So it was a complete shock. I had no idea that.
Yeah. Yeah. What? Tell us about your reaction, like when you heard the news.
I was quite scared. Mm-hmm. I was in complete shock. I was reading it and I don't think I read the whole thing. I stopped and I don't know if it was like a robot maneuver or something, but I just started packing a bag and I drove back to St. Louis to see her. And, I forgave her, pretty much on the spot. I mean, that was a long drive. I mean, it's already a 5+ hour drive, but I was thinking about it the whole time and I just thought, you know, I really got to just forgive her. And a lot of it was just cause I felt like that was what a good guy should do or would do, but not out of any sort of faith or anything. Yeah. I just felt kind of just an obligation almost.
Well, and that's interesting to me. I'm just going to interrupt here for a second because most guys, I mean, especially a guy who doesn't claim to have any faith, you would think that you would have been relieved. Like, oh, good. You know, okay, well, you just dealt with that. So what do you think was happening in your spirit that you, that really you were at a point where you would forgive her? You know, I mean, it's almost like you would have thought, you know, oh, okay, well, good. Or at least have said, well, you know, it's your choice because it's your body, or having been operating in that sphere.
Yeah, I don't know. I wish I knew. I knew that, I mean, and this is the part that really sickens me, is that part of me was a little relieved. And that to this day just, it just cuts to the core, you know, that I felt that way. But I don't know. I knew that I liked her a lot, and it was just, we'd been invested in one another's lives for long enough where I just felt like, well,
yeah,
I'm just gonna forgive her. I don't know.
And was that pretty much then the end of the relationship, or what happened after that, and who did or not tell others? Like, was there any disclosure among people that you loved about this?
No, there wasn't. Definitely not.
So you guys just lived in silence.
We did. We talked about it most of that weekend. And then after that, we just carried on like nothing happened.
Okay. And how much longer did you date, or were you in a relationship?
For about another year.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Yeah.
So.
Okay. So neither of you really dealing with this either together or on your own. So it was just kind of like trying to put it in the past.
Exactly.
For that point and move on.
Yeah.
So obviously the relationship didn't work out. It ended for other reasons.
It did. Yeah. Well, that's a whole other story, but part of the larger story, I suppose, that about the next fall, that next semester rather of my junior year, I started going to Campus Crusade, meetings. Mainly because my roommates were going and they seemed to have a good time and they definitely did. I think you can speak into that, Tiffany.
Tiffany's like, yeah, it's a lot of time. Yeah. She's like, yeah, I know about that.
But I don't actually remember seeing you year much at all. We didn't even go to that big of a college either, so you think we'd bump into each other more. But
yeah. And you even became a leader.
Yeah.
Like, so, not even being a believer.
Yeah, so that's the crazy
Hello,
part.
Hello, crew people. Please, let's evaluate our leadership. Well, no, I mean, that's just a side note.
Yeah, okay, but go ahead. I hope that doesn't throw anybody under the bus, but late, I guess.
I'm all about throwing people under the bus on this show, Micah, so, you know, no surprises there.
Yeah, no, so I was going and just enjoying it. I wasn't really going to church or anything, but I did go to Crusade, and I didn't do any Bible studies or anything that they offered, but I just went to their weekly meetings. And towards the end of the year, they were kept, I think, like 3 or 4 weeks in a row, they made some announcement that, hey, we're looking for somebody to join the fundraising and finance committee, because we were a catalytic campus, which means we just didn't have leadership on campus. It was very student run.
Okay.
And so I think after the first 2 or 3 times, I said, well, I looked around and I don't think there's any business majors who come to these things. And so I said, well, I'm probably qualified. So if they make the announcement one more time, I'll just throw my hat in. And okay. I said, oh yeah, I'll definitely join. And then he said, well, we really just need somebody to lead it. Would you mind doing that? And I actually did. I prayed about it a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, as much as I knew how.
Yeah.
And I said, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I told him I would.
Well, so meanwhile in the club, there's this girl named Tiffany. And how, Tiffany, let's tell a little bit about, from your perspective, when do you first remember meeting Micah? And how, from your perspective, did you start getting to know him in the context of this?
The first time we met was the next year after that. Hmm. And his roommate was good friends with one of my roommates, and they all didn't have class on Fridays and started hanging out at our house and had movie nights on Thursday nights. And one of the nights I finally had my stuff done soon enough that I could join the movie night, and I came in kind of at the end, and the seat left was next to Micah, and I sat down, and that's where we actually first met and talked, and we think we'd seen each other maybe once or twice before that, but it wasn't like we never talked before that.
Okay. So this guy's in crew, and he's a leader in crew. How did you guys develop a friendship, and how long basically was it before you were like, I'm not really sure where this guy is spiritually? Because you were, I mean, spoiler alert, weren't you the one that eventually did kind of bring him around to a true faith in Christ and introduce him on that?
I would say she was more of the closer.
Okay.
You know, I mean, if you, yeah, well, I think of it more of a baseball analogy. You got the starting pitcher who's planting the seed of faith, and then you have relief pitchers along the way. And she was just the closing pitcher.
Kind of God put her in that sequence of helping you understand.
And purely as a friend too. I mean, we weren't.
Okay.
I mean, I liked her, but she was just cool to hang out with.
Yeah. So. Okay. So what then to that point, Micah, talk about how, really, when did that moment come about where you realized, I need to have a real relationship with Christ. This needs to go in some direction where I take it internally into my spirit.
Sure. Yeah. So, I was going to, all these leadership meetings early in the year, mm-hmm. and, actually even started going to, one of the churches that some of the folks from our crusade were going to, or mm-hmm. should I say crew. Mm-hmm. and, I was, actually taught, I was still dating, mm-hmm. The girl at the time, and it was long distance, and so we were on the phone, and she said, hey, I hear something in your voice. She just kind of stopped me in the middle of me telling some story, and she said, hey, I hear something in your voice, are you okay? And I said, well, I'm fine, kind of brushed it off, and honestly I didn't think there was anything wrong. And then the next morning, for whatever reason, I was thinking about that comment and just stuck with me, and I'm like, well, am I okay? You know, is there something wrong? And so I just felt some stirring inside. And so I grabbed, I had a Bible, and I pulled it out, and I just started flipping through, looking at all the headlines and trying to find something that was speaking to me. And, finally happened upon the calming of the storm at sea. And, I stopped and I started reading it. And, I read it again and again, probably three or four times before I actually started reading it out loud. Luckily my roommate was out, so he didn't think I was a complete weirdo just reading scripture spontaneously out loud. And I read it out loud two or three times, and it just started speaking to me more and more each time. And I just realized there's definitely a storm going on in my life, and I had no idea it was there. And I felt just that God was just calling me to learn more about him. And to make it real. And so I just felt moved to break up with my girlfriend at the time. And so I did. That next weekend I drove in and laid on the bad news, but was honest with her, did it in person, and just told her what happened. I actually told her what happened, and she was actually kind of excited, because I think she knew that something good was going to happen.
Mm-hmm. So okay. And then how long was it? Meanwhile, you two are still friends. How long was it before you guys started dating?
Well, gee, that was, what, August or September? So we didn't actually start dating until December. Okay. So it was a few months.
Okay. A few months. Yeah. Started dating, and you dated how long before you knew you were going to get married, before you got engaged or?
Before we got engaged, it was about like 11 months.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And actually, there's a piece in the story that's kind of missing in that I started joining a Bible study. I started mm-hmm. going to the church that some of the guys were going to mm-hmm. and was just embedded in all this fellowship. And I just didn't know. This was just so crazy because I'm just discovering this whole faith thing yeah. as I was going. And it was just more and more unreal and surreal. Mm-hmm. And, but I hadn't really, I still hadn't just really made a commitment yet, mm-hmm. you know? And so we were walking home, with a group of folks, from one of the crusade meetings, and Tiffany kind of came alongside and said, "Hey, what are you doing tonight?" And I said, "I don't know, just hanging out, I guess." Mm-hmm. I didn't really have any studies to do. And she's like, "Oh, why don't you hang out, you know, come out and hang out." So we were at her dinner table and in her apartment, and I don't know where your roommates were, upstairs studying probably.
I don't know.
Or mm-hmm. Hitting the town, who knows. And mm-hmm. anyway, so she had, I think you can speak into this more, but just had an inkling that there was something missing still. And mm-hmm. so she said, "Hey, I can kind of tell you're not quite all in, you know, mm-hmm. so what's kind of holding you back?" And I just mm-hmm. said, you know, I'd gone to a lot of retreats growing up and felt the warm fuzzies of being in fellowship and whatever it is, and as soon as the weekend was over, I'd come home, nothing had changed, mm-hmm. and I was still the same rotten idiot that I was before. And so I don't know exactly what she said, but what she did say just made me feel comfortable enough just to just pray and just be real with God, you know, accept yeah. it all the way.
Yeah.
So but yeah, it was like a month or so after I accepted Christ though that I was praying just during my time of devotionals or quiet time, and she came on my mind, and mm-hmm. I was just praying about it, and I felt like God was saying, "Hey, you need to ask this girl out." Mm-hmm. You know, we were kind of to the point where we're hanging out a lot, and mm-hmm. it was pretty obvious that we had mutual feelings, but we're trying to do our best to not hang out exclusively yeah. together, yeah. so we'd only hang out with other people who were around. Mm-hmm. Just mm-hmm. to keep it real. And
so you're finally like, "We got to call this what it is."
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So yeah. It was definitely to that point, and I was just, and God was like, "You need to ask her out." And I pushed back. Actually, I was like, "There's no way this is from God. Mm-hmm. This is what I probably just want." And mm-hmm. I felt completely unworthy mm-hmm. from just my past relationships mm-hmm. that I would be asked to be a leader in a relationship mm-hmm. That soon, especially.
Sure. Yeah,
and so it was one of the few times I actually got down on my hands and knees, on my face, praying, and I pushed back on God. He pushed back on me. Mm-hmm. Eventually, I gave in, mm-hmm. and I caught Tiffany as she was jumping in the car to go home for Christmas break, and I said, "Hey, this is what I feel God asking me to do. Mm-hmm. I'd really like it if you'd go out with me." And but I don't want you to answer right away. I said, "Don't answer right away. I want you to pray about it too." So
it's one thing if you move into a relationship, and even if you're a newer believer and you're, like you said, you're on your face asking God for just wisdom and stuff. But when you know kind of where you'd come from, how did you make that transition? When did you feel comfortable telling her not only about your past relationships, but about the abortion itself and your role in that? Was that something that was easy to disclose, or was there a process there? Did you have any qualms about coming clean with that and wondering how she would react?
Definitely. I was worried. I actually, first when we were dating early on, I just told her that I'd had been in a physical relationship, mm-hmm. But I hadn't gone so far to tell her about the abortion. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until we were really close to, it was either we were going to get engaged or we weren't, you know, we had to make that, we were just at that apex. Mm-hmm. And I decided I needed to tell her mm-hmm. before then. I didn't want to tell her while we were engaged. I want to give her a chance to get out. Mm-hmm. You know, to have a chance to be like, you know what, this is too much for me. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get out. And so, yeah, I did. I told her. And
Tiffany, what was your reaction? What do you remember thinking?
Well, so at the beginning of our relationship, we came up with this little like saying that we would say to each other. I don't even really know how that got started, but we would say, well, I'm not perfect and I don't expect you to be either. Mm-hmm. And we were seeing each other because by this time we were a long distance and we were going to see each other, and it was right around like our, we had been dating for 10 months, right around that like anniversary mark. And for some reason, God just laid it on my heart that I should do something for this anniversary. And I made this little like book thing that was talking about being imperfect but still beautiful. And that I spent like the week before this happened, like he told me, working on that. Mm-hmm. And I think that God used that to help prepare me as much as you can be prepared for hearing this news. I think he used that. And then he told me, and I walked away from him for a while and just remember praying. And I don't really remember what was going through my head at that time, but just knowing that he wasn't the same person that I had, you know, seen who he is now, and that it's not the same of who he was then, and God restores and makes new, and that past is in the past, and I was gonna stay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you obviously moved forward into engagement and then got married. And talk to us a little bit about now and even, you know, immediately after you got married, your decision to have kids. How have you guys, I mean, have you had to wrestle? Were there ramifications of this in the past that even now you've had to grapple with, either you personally, Micah, or you two in your marriage? How have you processed past decisions in light of where you are now?
Do you want to feel this one?
Sure. Well, I didn't want to talk about it, and I didn't want anything to do with it. So I
and I could feel that too, because once we were engaged and married, I felt like, oh, we can kind of grapple with this together. And so, whenever I kind of carefully broached the subject, it was kind of just, yeah, I could feel that you didn't want to talk about it, and it became a very short conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Kind of like that, you know, that was in the past. Let's just forget it. Let's ignore it, you know.
Yeah. For whatever reason, it was, if I ignore it, it'll just go away. And obviously that's not true. Mm-hmm. But that was the first 4 years of our, almost 4 years of our marriage, was we just didn't really talk about it. And I tried not to think about it because it was kind of painful, and
definitely.
And meanwhile, were you having kids of your own?
Not yet.
Okay.
Actually, this is funny because we started off with sort of a 5-year plan. We were going to wait about 5 years before having kids.
Okay.
And then we had this, I'd say, just a benchmark conversation that this one Christmas, where Tiffany had gotten received a book from a friend that kind of had a similar story. It was
It
was a fiction story, Christian fiction story, in a similar circumstances.
Yeah. And just reading that, I decided, I was like, oh, I can talk about this and I can ask questions. And for some reason, I didn't, part of why I didn't want to talk about it, because I didn't think I could have questions about it. And yeah, so finally I started asking him questions, and
yeah, we had this great, awesome conversation, and it was just a whole nother level of intimacy that we'd ever had in that first 4 years. And And then about 9 months later, we had a child. So
not exactly. It was like 11. Thank you.
But the funny thing is that
we're doing the math.
The 5 year plan actually would have ended. Our 5 year anniversary was like September, and then our first child was born in October. Okay. So it was almost exactly a 5 year plan.
So Tiffany, would you say your biggest hurdle as far as really being able to kind of open the floodgates and start talking about this, was it the past sexual relationships or was it the baby or just a combination of both? What were you trying to forget?
the baby is still the hard part for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just how... Micah, when you know that, when you hear that, how do you respond?
I agree. It's the hardest part for me too. Mm-hmm. It's helped that I have actually run into some guys who've been in the same situation and are believers, and it's really helped kind of me wrestle with it. Mm-hmm. But that's definitely the hardest part. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were talking, I think this was probably like four or five months ago. We're talking about it, and she said, "Do you wish she hadn't had the abortion?" And that was so hard, because obviously, on one hand, I definitely wish she hadn't. Mm-hmm. But then at the same time, I have two kids now who mm-hmm. are just beautiful little girls, and mm-hmm. I've got this great wife, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, well, what would that have meant, you know? Like, mm-hmm. I don't know. And so that's just so hard to grapple with. Mm-hmm. It is so hard.
Yeah.
Well,
you and I have actually had a conversation with a mutual friend who has walked through this and talking about how it took him years to accept the fact that he has a son that is not around.
Yeah.
And, you know, just putting a name to that son as he did and putting a face to him and acknowledging that rather than just calling him a mistake as he did for years, you know, is a whole other level of, you know, bringing God, I think, into the equation. And Tiffany, like you're saying, and in a very emotional way, you're invited into that story now, too. Yeah. And so it really is, you know, and it's weird to think, you know, someday, you know, when we see the Lord and we are reunited, you know, reunited with this baby. I mean, it really is a familial kind of thing to recognize that and reconcile that, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I was just one of the times I was just praying about this whole thing and just really aching. And I don't know how biblical this is, but it's just, hey, it happened. So I'm just going to say it. I had just this feeling, overcoming feeling of just God's arms around me and just and sort of a vision almost of God holding a baby and just the implication that he's got the baby and is taking care. And it made me cry so hard, but it was so soothing. And so when I start getting really down about it, I definitely think about that God's just awesome. He's forgiven me and is all over this child.
Yeah. Well, there is so much more of this story that could be told. And obviously, you know, your hearts are so in it on a very deep level. I just wanted to, as we close here, just ask either of you, for someone who's listening, who... you know, maybe they're in a sexual relationship, but haven't gotten pregnant, or maybe they have had an abortion, or maybe they are a guy, Micah, who got a girl pregnant and is either, you know, waiting to see what she's going to decide or trying to help her make that decision, or she already made the decision. What's just some encouragement from where you are, from each of your perspectives, about how to trust God in the midst of this, how to look at this situation, you know, you being on this side of it, just any parting advice or encouragement for those who may feel the guilt and shame or the uncertainty surrounding this?
I would just say that God, like I said before, God is awesome. And if he can forgive me, he can forgive you. And that that you're not disqualified from having a beautiful wife and two or more, I don't know, you know, from having just awesome children. Hmm. Like, you're not beyond saving, you're not beyond forgiveness, and you're not beyond having an awesome relationship.
Hmm. From my perspective and my side of it all, the biggest thing that I struggled with was feeling like it was okay that I struggled with this, that my feelings of pain and hurt were valid, because I came in well after it was all over, you know, and I didn't think that was okay. For, I don't know why I believe that, but I did. And that was another reason it took us so long to really talk about it. Mm-hmm. But that your feelings are valid and that you should not just keep them inside and go find someone you can talk to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's good advice. And I think that's great advice to close with, just that whole idea of, you know, find, there's so much more hurt when it's kept in the dark. Find someone that you can talk to. Find someone who can pray with you.
Definitely.
Find someone like the Micah and the Tiffany in your life who have gone through this and who are willing to talk about it and willing to be an encourager in the midst of that and say, you know, I like what you said, Micah, that God's not out to sit there. He's not looking for people to punish, you know. Mm-hmm. He's not sitting there saying, oh, sorry, you no longer deserve, you know, XYZ. You no longer deserve a family. You no longer. But he's in the business of redemption and bringing stories around.
Yeah. I mean, even when we had our first kid, when Tiffany was pregnant, I was scared that God was going to take the baby, you know, like she would have a miscarriage or something. And I was just paranoid that it was just God was just going to punish me. Mm. I know that was just obviously not right. I mean, not biblical at all. Mm-hmm. And just having our first child was just awesome. And so it was I wouldn't say that just having the kid was redeeming, but it was definitely an affirmation that God was awesome.
Yeah. Well, thank goodness that our standing before God is on his merit and not on ours for any number of reasons, whether or not you have walked through a story like yours or whether or not you have a story of any kind of sinfulness, anything in your past, anything that you've struggled with or not struggled with. God is there and he is faithful. He's consistent.
Definitely.
So thank you too so much for opening up.
Sure. Anytime.
Time and time again.
Well, hey, folks, as we open up this week's culture segment, I'm always telling you about the great folks that we introduce you to because they are either authors or artists or theologians or a combination, all the above. Many of you have probably heard of Oz Guinness, and he is here with us today. So welcome to you.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
This is also part of our series of people with great accents. So we brought you in specifically for that, Oz. No, no one cares about my accent because it's just plain Jane American, but we try to mix it up a little bit here. Okay, well, in addition to being an author and a social critic, an editor of a number of books, in fact, I think you have written or edited 30 books I have here, so that's kept you busy from a long time before. You were a leader. This was interesting for me to know. You were a leader at Le Brie back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm. With had the privilege of being there. Fascinating time.
Yeah, absolutely. And so obviously with Francis Schaeffer at that time. So
I lived with him.
That's fabulous. And then you founded, in 1991, the Trinity Forum, which you have been involved with for a long time, and we're into the 2000s, and currently living in Virginia, and, of course, writing and speaking and being around and about, a cultural commentator and more. We're going to have a discussion, not that we can discuss all of his 30 books, but specifically we want to talk about a book called God in the Dark, The Assurance of Faith Beyond a Shadow of Doubt. And we knew he's... Oz Guinness is visiting us here at Focus on the Family and taping with our daily broadcast, of course. And we thought, in light of this topic, this was a great and applicable one for our audience, because I think a lot of young adults are moving through that season of just kind of, what do I believe? What does this look like? Can I really take it as my own? My life isn't exactly what I thought it would be. And so where do I go from here? And so we're going to start talking through some of the themes of this book, because obviously... Oz is a few steps ahead of us, and so we always love to learn from folks in that context. So I think the first thing I kind of wanted to open up with, in fact, you were quoted as saying here within the book, if ours is an examined faith, we should be unafraid to doubt. There's no believing without some doubting, and believing is all the stronger for understanding and resolving doubt, which seems to be a little bit of a contradiction, because most people will say, you just can't doubt. You just have to not doubt. Don't ask the questions. You know, is that kind of some of that thinking that bred the start of the book, or at least...
Well, that's really the main reason I wrote the book. I met so many people who felt guilty about doubting, and they felt bad, as if they were letting the side down. But actually, doubt is something much more natural than that. In other words, you've got two extremes. Well, they're not extremes, but two poles. One is faith, and the other is disbelief or skepticism. And doubt is a halfway house. So it's very, very natural that, whatever the reason is, people's strong faith gets knocked on the head for one reason, and they have doubts. Now, the point is to resolve it, because doubt as a halfway house never stops. It's like a coin spinning. It'll come down heads or tails, and there's no other position. So doubt will always go back to faith again, or out to unbelief. But there's nothing wrong with doubting itself.
Okay.
And so I wrote it for people who are feeling bad. Don't feel bad about it. Just face up to it. And then, by God's grace, resolve it.
Yeah, and I know you make the point, or early on in the book, kind of this idea that, you know, if we have doubts, it means that we're not intellectually rigorous, or we just, you know, many people will just choose to say, well, I just don't know, so I would rather not ask the questions, rather not think about it. How do you say... Mr. Guinness, how do you say that admitting doubt actually could lead or lend itself to intellectual integrity in light of that, especially in light of the world, you know, and what they perceive of us?
When someone has a doubt, the question is why? And usually there's something wrong in the way that they're now believing, so that it was unsettled in some way and they're doubting. So one has to look into the reasons why they're doubting, and if they can resolve those, they move back to faith. If they can't resolve those, the questions are too deep, the challenges are too strong, maybe they'll move on to unbelief, but they don't need to. So that's the challenge. Why?
Right. And you know, I think a lot of us, especially Christians, when we think of doubt, we think that there's something that's been stated, you know, all the big things we talk about, like, you know, intelligent design, creation, you know, factual things. We think that we have to, like, look at this fact and decide whether or not we're going to doubt. But you actually make the argument that doubt isn't just intellectual, it's actually personal. And how so?
Well, it can be intellectual. In other words, in the book, I've tried to outline some of the categories of doubt, but we've got to start with the intellectual, because a lot of people duck that today, and people have doubts because they ducked it in coming to faith. For example, the only final reason to believe is that we're convinced the Christian faith is true. Not that it works, but it's true. It works because it's true. It's not true because it works. But if anyone has believed for some reason less than that, and then they're challenged afterwards by a philosopher or a skeptic or someone like that, they'll begin to, maybe I'm just believing because I have needs. And they'll fall prey to, say, the objections of people like Sigmund Freud. So they need to go back and really understand why they believe what they believe, and particularly how they know the Christian faith is true. What you mentioned, La Brea, I was at La Brea, and I remember a Christian girl came from the U.S., this is late 1960s, and she said at the end with a smile, "You know, I always knew the Christian faith was true, but I never realized how true it was," which is absurd if you look at it one way. If it's true, it's true, it's true. Mm-hmm. But clearly she didn't have the solid foundations of a biblical understanding of truth. So when the doubts came, she doubted.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a very important, so when I say it's personal, mm-hmm. but we're more than minds.
Mm-hmm.
Take an example of emotional belief. I love the story that I call the Elijah syndrome. Here's dear old Prophet Elijah. He takes on 850 people. And then at the end of his great victory over the prophets of Baal, he runs all the way back to Samaria, which must have been pretty exhausting too. Mm-hmm. And then the next day, he's threatened by Jezebel. He'd taken on all these forces. The next day, he's completely deflated.
Mm-hmm.
And he runs for his life and says, "Lord, take my life. I'm ready to die." The Lord doesn't rebuke him. The Lord does not give him an intellectual answer.
Mm-hmm.
He gives him a sleep and a meal, mm-hmm. twice over.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Elijah needed. And there are times, for instance, when people have been stretched for God emotionally. They're absolutely drained. And then question strikes in and they doubt. Mm-hmm. But we shouldn't be too hard on them, and they shouldn't be too hard on themselves. What they need is some emotional rest or refreshment or a vacation or whatever. Because
mm-hmm.
that kind of doubt is emotional rather than intellectual. So the key thing is to say, why is someone doubting? And what is the appropriate resolution for that particular type of doubt?
Okay, so I want to get into some of these types of doubt, because you actually outline what you call seven families of doubt. But first off, I have to have you answer the question that I know some people are thinking right now, and they're going to say, okay, but what about James 1:6? Because there we're told to ask for wisdom, but we can't, you know, when we ask, you must believe and not doubt. And so they're going to say, God's telling us not to doubt. We just have to march ahead and go forward. How does that fit into the context of healthy doubt?
Well, of course, faith is wholehearted, is one-minded, and doubt is double-minded. Mm-hmm. James is the one who says that too. A person who's doubting is in two minds. That was the original title of my book, but the publisher thought it was a little too intellectual. So doubt is not a good state.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying you should doubt.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying if we are doubting, we shouldn't be too hard on ourselves. It's not unnatural, and it should be resolved. So yes, we should, when we pray, have one mind about our trust in the Lord mm-hmm. and our absolute confidence he can answer our prayers as he's promised to do.
Mm-hmm.
So we shouldn't pray doubting.
Okay. Okay. Well, let's talk about these seven families of doubt, because you devote much of the book to that. And I thought it was very helpful and practical in walking through these to realize, yeah, this is the one that trips me up, or this is the one, you know, I've definitely seen myself here. What would you say? I want to bring up a couple of them in particular, but overall, how would you summarize what these seven families or areas of doubt are, and why are they pretty comprehensive even among believers, you know, to show within our lives?
Because there are really only so many particular ways that we can doubt or are caused to doubt. They could have added, as if I wrote it today, in that book I was written over 40 years ago, so I can't actually remember a lot of the details in it myself. I've written so many since then. I could have added doubts that come from our social context.
Mm-hmm.
You look at where we are in the advanced modern world today. On the one hand, we've got what's called pluralization. Lots of other people with lots of other different ideas, lots of other different lifestyles all around us. And so it's not unnatural for people to say, am I just believing this because of my family background, or I happen to go to that church? And doubts come in just because of all the differences that, like a gigantic supermarket of our ideas, are around us. Or you could take something else. Many people in the West feel the brunt of the onslaught, say, of the new atheists.
Mm-hmm.
So we are faith heads, as Richard Dawkins says. We believe without any reason, and there's no reason in our believing, which is absolute nonsense. Saint Augustine says Christians think in believing, and they believe in thinking.
Mm-hmm.
But you can see a lot of Western Christians, either because of pluralism or because of the skepticism of the atheist attacks, they're prone to doubt. So you could add others apart from the seven I've mentioned, but mm-hmm. we need to have a realistic understanding of what are the temptations that are likely to come our way. So that, for instance, I mentioned the Elijah syndrome. Mm-hmm. I often warn people who are absolutely exhausted because they've done something truly heroic. This is probably the greatest temptation they'll face when they're tired. But we need to know the doorways to doubt.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So one of the ones that you list, one of the seven families, you talk about doubt from lack of growth, which I think, you know, it's funny because it seems so elementary, but it really is. I mean, there are so many Christians out there who lament the fact that they don't understand God and why isn't God revealing this and why doesn't God take their hand and lead them or tell them exactly what to do, but they have no interest in being in his word or really looking mm-hmm. at any kind of existing revelation, obviously the word of God and through prayer and whatever. Which is interesting because I've had conversations with friends and we have all agreed that we're much less prone to wander, per the hymn, or doubt when we are really plugged into the Word of God and when we are walking with Him, when we are abiding, a la John 15. And is that something, I mean, could you speak a little bit to that as far as the person who, you know, wants all this Jesus but doesn't want the relationship mm-hmm. in light of that?
No, you've described it well. But take something very simple like movement. How do you learn to ride a bike? Well, you have to have the trust. Mm-hmm. That although you're afraid of going too fast because you don't know how to ride a bike yet, if you stop, what happens? You fall off.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of Christians have stopped. They're stationary, mm-hmm. and they're wondering why they aren't growing. So mm-hmm. one of my favorite quotations and something I love is George Whitefield, the great evangelist. In his journals, he says, "I am never better than when I'm on the full stretch for God." It's when he's putting himself out of his comfort zone
mm-hmm.
that he grows. He's cast on the Lord and finds the Lord in ways he didn't know him before.
Mm-hmm.
And people who haven't grown, well, they may be, say, 40, mm-hmm. and in their career on Wall Street or law, whatever they're into, mm-hmm. they're really mature adults, and yet they've got a faith that would be the equivalent to what they had as a teenager in Sunday school.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not surprisingly, they'll have doubts.
Sure.
Whatever level we've reached in life should be the level at which our faith has grown too, mm-hmm. hopefully even more so. Mm-hmm. So if people who don't grow, they're bound to have doubts because their faith will be beneath them.
Yeah. And here's one way that you put it in the book, which I appreciated because I think it's so true of where we are today, even in evangelical circles. You say our attachment to Christian things is stronger than God himself. Can you illustrate that for us a little bit, just in a modern context of, you know, how we're so prone? I mean, we're joining Bible studies, we're on worship teams, we're, you know, now tweeting and on Facebook with any manner of Christian organization, mm-hmm. but almost using it as a substitution for God himself. How have you seen that?
Well, you know, Paul, in his letter to Timothy, talks about the church as the pillar and bulwark of the truth. And social scientists call that the church's the plausibility structure. In other words, the Christian faith is true, but you join a church and it demonstrates and makes live to you all the meaning of the truth. Now, the trouble is, we can so enjoy the church and its activities and our Christian friends and our Bible studies and our meetings that we forget the purpose of it all, which is the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people have to stop, you know, suffering from meeting-itis,
mm-hmm.
and remember the priority, which is to know the Lord. Because we look at the Gospels, Jesus calls us three things, really, all of us. First is to know and trust him and through him, his Father. The heart of it is relationship. That must be above all in everything.
Mm-hmm.
The second is to live his way, and the third is to introduce others to know him too.
Mm-hmm.
But if ever we forget the first thing, we're in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And often Christian activities can be so wonderful that they help us forget.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Something else that helps us forget, this is one of the other families of doubt that you outlined that I thought was great because it's almost an opposite of the problem of
intellect and busyness is the unruly emotions. And, you know, I think we can get, you know, we'll say, you know, oh, well, you know, this is my reality. What I'm feeling is my reality, which probably isn't the truth. So how would you say unruly emotions precipitate doubt?
Well, in our so-called postmodern world, truth is dismissed. Mm-hmm. Well, if truth isn't a part of it, we're left either to our will or our emotions. And no secret that many American Christians and others in the modern world across the world, you know, have a faith that's largely to do with their emotions. When they feel good, God is there. And when they feel down, he's distant, and so on. And our emotions are notoriously fickle. Mm-hmm. And we can see that in the Psalms. And the psalmist actually talks to his emotions. Why are you cast down, my soul? And he challenges them. And we've got to be objective enough to know that we can't live on our feelings. We need truth. We need the commitment of the will. And we've got to address our emotions so they don't run away with us. We're in control, mm-hmm. not them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. What, so kind of as we, and I'm talking here to Oz Guinness, we're talking about his book, one of many of his books, God in the Dark, The Assurance of Faith Beyond a Shadow of Doubt. So for that, let's talk specifically to that 20-something who's listening today and who, you know, maybe they feel they're a doubt disaster. They don't even know where to start. They're just, they feel they're a project. What would you recommend as some first steps for really starting to tackle the things they're grappling with, even having an understanding where some of this is sourced out of, and where can they get, obviously God's word being a huge one, but where kind of can they start those baby steps to really having assurance in some of these areas?
Well, I'd say first, be honest. Mm-hmm. In other words, face the situation you're feeling or experiencing, be honest. Mm-hmm. So the Christian life is not a matter of stuffing down the way we feel, a form of denial. No, be honest. Secondly, don't feel bad. Mm-hmm. Almost everybody has doubted at some time. And our Lord on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Clearly, our Lord felt an abandonment even of that intimacy he'd enjoyed with his Father. Mm. Doubt is human. Doubt is natural in a fallen world. So be honest. Don't feel bad. And then ideally, go to a person who understands. A book is second rate mm-hmm. compared with a person. But mm-hmm. a lot of people don't know people who understand it. So go to a book. When I wrote mine, there were very few. Mm-hmm. There are hundreds of thousands of books on faith, but there are remarkably few books on doubt. When I wrote that, I could only lay my hands on about half a dozen, which is really quite remarkable. But think as to what sort of doubt it is that you're facing, and then by God's grace, pursue the way that that particular doubt can be resolved. Now, I haven't read my book for 40-odd years. I can't even remember if you turn me to page whatever. I can't remember. But that's, of my books, the oldest one still in print. It was never a vast seller. Mm-hmm. Still in print, and there's hardly a week goes by, I don't get an email or a letter all across the world, in Kenya or New Zealand or Alabama, and someone saying, you know, page 75 or page whatever, mm-hmm. save my faith because you helped me understand doubt mm-hmm. and assure me that I needn't feel guilty about it and it could be resolved. Mm-hmm. So I'm always incredibly grateful before the Lord at how that's spoken to many people when they're in the grip of doubt.
Well, and that matters, and I think it is so. I mean, it speaks to community, even though a community on the page, you know, people who have read this and who have felt encouraged by that. I think that's big and that's important. I think it's also fun to mention as we wrap up here. One thing I didn't say in your bio is that you are, what is it, the great 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 grandson of the Irish brewer. Some people in our audience are going to be all excited about that. So the name, so that you don't have to write to us, everyone, and say, is he related to Guinness? Have you gotten any kickback from that?
Is that work for you?
That's good.
Both the brewery and all the Guinness Book of Records, is both of them are our family. But my ancestor, Arthur Guinness, came to faith in Jesus through the preaching of John Wesley in the Irish Revival, and he built in generosity, social responsibility, healthcare, housing, all sorts of things for the workers and for people in Dublin at large in 250 odd years ago. Oh. So I'm very proud of that tradition.
That's a lot of fun. And it kind of, it's just fun. It's fun to put a face to a name and like, these are real people. That's really fun. And, you know, and you go from doubt to all of that. So, well, thank you so much. Again, Oz Guinness speaking to us for what he knows, a guy with a life's breadth of experience of not only being able to instruct others in the circles he's run in, but also a relationship with God personally that has gone the distance. So thanks for carving out time for us.
My pleasure. My faith means everything to me and is the center and soul of my thinking and action. So doubt is something that knocks at the heart of that. So it's very, very important to resolve it, but it can be, to get back to a really assured faith.
Absolutely.
When I look into the sky, I see the touch of an artist's hand. I see the world that you designed. Here in all, I humbly stand. Who compares to you? Oh Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name. With the earth we rejoice, while the angels sing your praise. How majestic is your name.
All right, folks, as we finish out the show, we will open up our inbox as we always do. Very pleased to have Deanna from Counseling here. Hey, Deanna.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well. Great to have you here. Thanks for hopping off the phone lines upstairs to answer one of our questions.
Sure.
We appreciate this. All right, this is it's a good one. It is from a girl, and she says, I have a strong desire to be married. Hey, you came to the right place. That's just me adding that. However, guys may not see me as approachable. I'm usually introverted in all the environments where I would get to know a guy. I'm afraid this will hold me back from connecting with anyone, so I don't know what to do. When I actually like someone, it feels like I'm missing a train that I want to hop on, but I can't. Aw, that was a good analogy. That is kind of a poor thing.
Yeah. All right. Well, introverts, you know, they drive a lot of their energy from their own emotions and their own ideas, where extroverts get all kind of revved up about outside, you know, people and things that are going on in the world and activities. So one good thing for her would be to have a plan. So if she has a friend that's more of an extrovert, then maybe they could go together and she could, like, you know, think of some questions that she could just go ahead and ask him or the group of people that she's around, that kind of things, but sort of have some of those things in advance. Mm-hmm. And have a friend that's maybe a little more outgoing that can sort of be that in-between person to bring you into the conversation. It's also good to kind of think of some questions ahead of time that you would like to ask him, because sometimes you just get there and you get really nervous and, you know, you don't really know what to say and then it's just awkward. So if you come in and you have some questions, then you're talking to him and you kind of have a purpose. It's not like you're just awkwardly standing there.
Yeah.
You also have to think about your body language. Some people are not really good at talking, but you can communicate a lot through your body language. So it's important to kind of, you know, pay attention to that and sort of where you stand and how you do that and, you know, how open you are to even having other people communicate with you. It's also good to go places that you are maybe a little more confident. So if there's, let's say there's, you're really good at tennis. Well, it may be good to go there, and that would be a good place to meet people because you're already good at that. You don't have any, you know, you're less likely to be, I guess, embarrassed or, you know.
And it gives you something to do, like, rather than just standing around awkwardly.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's always good to have something to do, whether that's eating or, you know, playing a game or whatever. And so then those moments of silence can kind of be filled up with that activity.
Mm-hmm. That's good. I like your idea of kind of, you know, not that, you know, extroverts, because I'm an extrovert, even though only a mild one. You know, not that, we're not saying go out and use every extrovert that you
right. you can find. Right. But I think extroverts, especially if you have an extrovert who is a friend who wants mm-hmm. to help you in this area, right. and they're like, you know what, let me help break the ice. Let me introduce you to so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. If you have someone in particular that you are interested in, this extrovert can maybe like work that friend network and kind of, right. you know, get an introduction or whatever. I think that's good. Though I would also say, and do you agree, Deanna, that I always counsel people, especially women, to not travel in packs. Like if you do go to an outing or a party or something like that, you know, don't hide behind the six right. extrovert friends that you have who are going to get the spotlight and who are going to, or don't go stand in the corner or up against the wall, right. you know, the true wallflower. Be by yourself a little mm-hmm. bit, you know, stand, maybe come out into the room, stand by yourself, wait for someone to approach you, see if it happens. If it doesn't, then you can go back, you know, but give someone a chance to approach you and start right. a conversation.
Well, and even like, you know, guys love food. Stand mm-hmm. by food and guys yeah. will come.
Yeah. Or the TV if it's like a football party.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah. 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 Anything like that. That's good. And then, yeah. And no one likes to just go, every time you go through the table, like if you have a buffet or it's a party or whatever, everyone always has to say something, because if you're going walking right. by someone, you have to like make some conversation. So that's a great opportunity, mm-hmm. as you said, to have a couple of those little go-to questions ready right. for just, you know, hey, who do you know here? Or how did you find out about this or whatever?
Right.
I think that's good and helpful. Yeah. Great pointers. Great way to get started. So thanks so much.
Sure.
Yay. All right, folks, that is it for this week's show. As always, we want to hear from you. Write to us at editor@boundless.org. But before you do that, make sure you go over to boundless.org/pursuit and get registered for Pursuit 2015 right here, July 9th through 11th. This is your last opportunity, the last show that you will hear before rates go up. So boundless.org/pursuit. Tell your friends, post it on your social media, let people know that you're coming, and be ready to represent. We're excited. So that is it for this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of boundless.org. Focus on the family.